Breakfast puppies?
We're all set to begin, so let's dive right in to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your cars, but mostly it's about dive bars. Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Hey, Poppy. What are we drinking tonight?
Tonight we are going to be drinking Tears of Vulcan, an orange wine from right here in beautiful northwestern Oregon.
What is an orange wine?
That's a very good question.
The only orange wine I know and is Punto.
My understanding is that the wine gets its color from how long it sits on the grape's skin while it is in primary fermentation. So instead of it being filtered out at a very early stage and being, you know, pressed down, it's allowed to hang out on its lovely skin and get this really interesting orange color.
So it hangs on to the vine.
It hangs on to its skin.
Raised from the depths of volcanic soils in the fiery Chehalem Mountains. Forged through the smoldering heat of savage fermentation and untamed skin contact. Tempered by cool, silent, still, Elvage comes.
Tears of Vulcan.
Oh. I was going to try and match you there, but you played a little switcheroo.
12.9% alcohol by volume. Contains sulfites.
Well, you've made it this far, guys. You're listening to another episode of Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Recorded, I almost said filmed, here in the Pacific Northwest, the lovely town of Portland, Oregon, where we have a huge wine scene. I am Nathaniel, and I have with me, as usual,
just Jacob,
Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
And today we are joined again by our good friend Poppy. Say hello, Poppy.
Hello, everybody. I'm so happy to be back.
Poppy joined us for the special bonus episode of Dungeon Crawl Classics Character Generation, where we made her get out of her wonderful bath to come and nerd out with us. And she was most grumpy but entertaining about the whole thing. If you haven't listened to that, you should check it out. It's a hilarious episode.
It was pretty funny.
I really enjoy it. And I mean, I know I'm biased because, like, y'all are my friends, and I just like listening to all of us like chatting and having a good time, but it is really quite funny. And I've learned my lesson in that I'm going to be taking my bath after we're done recording because there's nothing quite like having a really nice glass of wine in the bathtub in the evening when you're just chilling out. So I think this will, it'll go well.
And speaking of wine, would you do the honors of pouring us in?
I will. And I want to mention that I have never had this wine before.
I don't think any of us have.
None of us have had this wine before. This is going to be new for me as well. We were convinced to buy this wine by our favorite wine shop purveyors. They told this story about this weird, this very unusual wine, and we were like, well, we must have that, and it must be our first wine review on Bikers, Dice, and Bars. I'm going to stand up and pop this cork for us.
Ooh la la.
Ooh la la la. I hope it'd be really embarrassing if I broke the cork. I hope that doesn't happen.
And I want to give a special shout out to Dan and Talina over at the Mom and Pop Wine Shop here in Portland, Oregon, for introducing this to us. Oh, that sounded nice.
Oh,
that sounded
nice. Yeah. Ooh.
Ooh, is there a little must on that? Ooh, yes, 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 yes.
Oh, look at that.
Look how pretty that is. Oh, my goodness.
Ooh.
Oh, I am excited about this. Cheers.
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 All right. So if you take a look at this wine, it is pretty cloudy. It's not.
Oh, I love the smell, too.
Yeah, well, we're going to get there. It's pretty. We're going to get there. Slow down.
Do I have to stare at it first before I drink it?
No, you don't have to. But it almost has the appearance of almost like a golden beer.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have that same kind of color you'd expect from a white wine, since, again, this is an orange wine. So this is a blend, actually. This is a 63% Viognier, 21% Pinot Gris, and a 16% Muscat. Yeah, so I'm going to give it a little swirl here, and I'm going to finally put my nose in it. Oh, that's nice. It might be a little too cold right now.
This is tasty.
Its viscosity on the roll is a lot lighter than I'd expect, yet it still has some great legs.
It's, you know, I noticed the legs as soon as I poured it. Like, mm-hmm. it's got some sexy legs,
it's
y'all.
It's got some sexy legs.
So, I'm not a wine snob. I don't know what that means.
I was just going to say, I don't know what you're saying. Okay. And so, I was hoping for more visual legs, and yet.
Yeah, so if you look down the side of your wine here, how it's dripping there. Do you see on mine here?
No, I see it.
Yeah, those are called legs. That has to do with how viscous the wine is and the alcohol content of the wine. And
that's absolutely fascinating. I never knew that.
I mean, they're like, ooh, nice legs, whatever. I really just think it's kind of pretty.
So explain the viscosity. I understand as far as the legs go. How does the mm-hmm. alcohol content play into the legs?
I actually don't know. Jacob, what do you got for me?
Well, I got a couple things.
Awesome. Thank you. I am the wannabe wine snob, y'all. I am a wine hobbyist. I am on a mission to learn more about wines. I've been drinking wine since I was 21. Yes. Uh-huh. And just in the last 2 years or so, I've really decided to dive in, learn more about what's going on with wine. I do not know everything yet. I may say stuff that is wrong. That is okay. If I'm wrong, please email me. I might read your emails the next time I'm here.
And
I don't
you
know.
Can reach her at poppy@breakfastpuppies.com.
There we go.
Excellent.
I'm going to do my
really
best.
If you really like this segment, let us know. We kind of want to bring her on some more to talk more about wine in the future.
So, Jacob, what do you know about legs?
What do I know about legs?
What do you know about legs there, baby?
Legs are fabulous.
Yes, they are.
Legs are, like you mentioned, are a function of viscosity. And different grapes produce different quality legs. Plus, how fermentation is handled also produces legs. Mm. When you're looking at legs, you're looking for a couple things. How fast the leg disappears, how clean the line is. A fast disappearing leg is probably been really rushed through fermentation. It also depends on whether you're dealing with a red, a white, a high sugar grape. So there's a lot of factors that go into it. One of the things that's also looked at is what's called trace. Trace is what happens as a leg disappears. It is not uncommon if you're drinking a cheaper wine, not price, mind you, but production quality, to see the line hang around longer where the liquid's disappeared, but there's like a streak on the glass. That's usually because they've used added sugar.
Let's save the rest of the wine talk a little bit for later on in the show when we actually dive into drinking and bars and even talk about some wine bars. But for now, let's hit the road. Jacob, I'm going to turn this one over to you because I know that you have really strong opinions on this. In fact, I'm pretty sure the whole table does, but you seemed quite ready to talk about this earlier. So let's just go there. Helmets, love them, hate them, they're a controversial subject. Jacob.
I love helmets. I love helmets for a lot of different reasons. One of this is, due to part of my long-term career, I've dealt with many individuals with traumatic brain injury. And so I have some very strong opinions on whether or not people should wear helmets. I also know people who the only reason they're walking around today is that they were wearing a acceptable Schnell-approved helmet, which, unlike a DOT helmet, will protect against a certain degree of spinal injury.
So we're talking about motorcycle helmets mostly. We'll probably also talk about bike helmets.
Allow me to branch off into that.
But real quick, tell us the difference between Schnell and DOT for people that don't know.
The difference between Schnell and DOT is both of them are standards. DOT stands for Department of Transportation. It's the federal standard for motorcycle helmets. Not all states require helmets. Not all states require DOT-approved helmets. Schnell is a different independent assessment of helmets and their ability to resist impact, abrasion, head flip, and a lot of other factors. So that's the big difference.
Okay. So Xander, helmets. Real quick, let's give it your opening opinion on this.
So my very brief and opening opinion is I am kind of a free choice kind of guy. There has also been statistics that show that riders who wear helmets are actually less safe than those who do, because those who wear helmets tend to have a false sense of security and are more likely to do more dangerous things while wearing them, whereas people without helmets tend to be much more cautious because of that fact.
All right, Poppy.
I, as it is with most things, I am of two minds about helmets. Personally, I think it is really, really stupid not to wear one. which I understand is putting it kind of judgmentally or whatever. But again, I also have worked with a number of people in my day job who have traumatic brain injuries from various and sundry different things. I have a good friend of the family who was horribly, horribly disabled in a motorcycle accident because he was not wearing a helmet, amongst other things. They were hit really hard. So I feel like, if, you know, it's like wearing a seatbelt in a car. It's just kind of, as they would say back in the Midwest where I'm from, it's just what you do, right? However, I also am a firm believer that people have the right to do with their own bodies as they see fit. Again, so while I personally would always wear a helmet and advocate for everybody that I know and love to wear one, at the end of the day, as a good feminist, it's your body, your choice.
It's a tough overlap to have those two different conflicting points of view. Like, I myself believe that people should have control over how they use their body, mm-hmm. similarly, and what, you know, the body is and is not allowed to do. But at the same time, I'm very pro helmet. That said, I cheat. Like, when I ride a bicycle, I frequently don't wear a helmet. It's fashion. That's it. Pure and simple.
I've had an idea of actually going, and I wanted to make a thing called Dapper Domes, in which I'm.
Yes, oh, please.
That's beautiful.
And it's going to be tricky to do, because I understand that given the shape of a helmet, it'll change how the ground impacts with your head and your neck and all those types of things. So obviously a top hat shaped helmet might actually snap your neck if you hit it on the wrong way.
This is true.
However, I was thinking of, you know, if you had a Buller or Derby style helmet, probably wouldn't be so bad, but it would also probably look fucking awesome. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I had in mind to solve that problem.
Oh, I was just going to say, I did not grow up using or wearing bicycle helmets at all. My folks never made us wear one, not because they were like, we don't care. It was because it was the 80s. Like,
where'd you grow up?
In northern Colorado. And we mostly rode our bikes around the neighborhood, and we lived in a little suburb, and there was big sidewalks and wide roads, and, you know, we just never really wore one. And then the first time I came to visit Portland before I moved here, we were going to go ride our bike somewhere, and they were like, we don't have enough helmets. And I'm like, that's no big deal, guys. Like, I never wear a helmet. Like, don't worry about it. And I got accosted given the lecture of my life by four or five different people, like, basically all at once. And that was in, I was 26 years old before I started riding a bicycle helmet. So, but now I'm all helmet all the time if I'm on two wheels.
When it comes to bicycles, I, like you, grew up not wearing bicycle helmets. You know, part of it is there's only a certain amount of speed you can hit on gravel roads that are graded regularly by the county. It's the graded regularly by the county that slows you down, makes the soil soft.
Okay.
But that said, I'm a big proponent of bicycle helmets. It is one of those things that, especially from a legalism issue, that if you're in a state that requires you to wear a motorcycle helmet, there is absolutely no reason they shouldn't be enforcing helmets for bicycles just as well. In both cases, the argument is social cost, and the social cost is actually equal.
Now, and you specifically work in an industry that you encounter that social cost and the impact that it has every day.
Exactly. In fact, there's in Portland, due to the Affordable Care Act and the expansion of medical costs, we are now seeing more individuals experience Medicaid-covered head injuries from bicycling, because more and more young people in the Pacific Northwest, Portland in particular, are riding around without helmets, but they're now on the Affordable Care Act. So when they go down, when they get clipped, whenever they shoot a stop sign and get tweaked about by a car, mm-hmm. their head gets hit by something. And at the very least, if you even do something small, like go over the hood of a Honda Prius because you ran a stop sign.
Toyota.
Sorry, you're right. Toyota Prius. When you go to the hospital, even if you're walking and talking right, there's a good chance they're going to order an MRI just because your head hit the ground.
And this is the kind of town where when you go over that Prius, that Prius is also a cyclist who will then get out of the car and lecture you about not wearing a helmet. Welcome to Portland.
Welcome to Portland.
Yeah. Or a Subaru.
One thing I'd also like to go off on is, go off, that's the wrong word. I understand the argument for not legally requiring motorcycle helmets. And there's something to be said for that, because I've actually had two friends who got into accidents that were directly fed into the fact they were wearing helmets. One of them was a friend who was driving at slow speed. I happened to be present. And because they were wearing a helmet in August in 98 degree weather, they got a case of heat stroke. And their accident was not them hitting anything. Their accident was they went from zero to heat stroke and fell off their bike.
Ouch.
Ouch. Wow. From a comfort standpoint, I can't wear most helmets. I have an enormous head. It's just a biological fact for me. I can't wear hats bought from stores. I can only get...
I got to take you to a proper haberdasher, sir.
A haberdasher is great. I can get custom hats, or I can go to like Hollywood Vintage, and they have a small selection of hats that fits my 3XL head. There are maybe five helmet manufacturers at the places that I've looked that have them at reasonable prices. HJC is one. Thank you for fitting my head. Another thing is I have to wear a modular helmet. Mm-hmm. I cannot get my head through the neck hole of a normal helmet, even one that is sized to fit me. My head is enormous. Mm-hmm. It sucks. Like, I can't buy helmets from stores. I have to custom order them, or Motorcycle Superstore or some online place.
Going off of that, yeah, the only thing more dangerous than not wearing a helmet
is wearing a poorly fitted one.
Helmet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Way worse for you. I mean, I think that's awesome, often under talked about, is that you might as well not wear one if you're not going to have it strapped on tight to your head.
Oh, same with bicycle helmets. Yep.
What I was referring to.
Yeah. I've seen so many people in Portland and surrounding areas, because I drive back and forth to, you know, one of our little sister cities every day. And I see so many people not wearing helmets properly. And I know basically nothing about helmets, but I know how you wear a bicycle helmet, and I know why it actually has to come down over your freaking prefrontal cortex, people.
Is that the important part of
your
head?
That's one of the really important parts of your head. But I see so many people wearing them like way far back on the back of their head, and it's, you might as well just not be wearing one.
It is the part that is most likely to hit the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And
that makes sense.
Yeah, so your prefrontal lobe, your forehead,
yeah,
is extremely important for doing things like living in polite society, mm-hmm. being able to have impulse control and make good decisions and all that kind of stuff. So I know more about brains than I do about wine.
The reverse of that is the fact that if you're wearing your helmet off, the backside will not prevent spinal roll, and you risk a higher chance of spinal injury.
Ooh.
So one thing that I found interesting that all of us said was we all agreed wearing a helmet is the smart and right thing to do. And I believe we also all said, I don't think that you should be forced to have to do it. Am I correct on this assessment?
There's reasons. It's okay. It's a complicated topic, which is why when I wrote this in our document, I wrote, let's talk about helmets and piss off half of our listeners.
Or all of them.
I think people that don't wear helmets are stupid.
Agreed.
Think you should wear a helmet. I think you should wear a properly fitted helmet, and you should learn how to wear it properly. It's part of taking a motorcycle training course. I think there should be bicycle training courses too. I think if you're going to be on two wheels on a road with cars that don't care about you, then you should know how to use the proper safety equipment. But most reasons I've seen for enforcing helmet laws are 0% related to public safety issues and 100% due to insurance regulation issues because the insurance companies lobby for it. And I have a hard time supporting anything that the insurance companies want because all they care about is making money and paying out less money for injuries. So the only reason that a lot of states have helmet laws is because insurance companies got tired of covering head injuries and convinced the state that they wanted to do it. It's a weird thing. Like, I believe that people should wear helmets, but I don't believe that the insurance companies, that we should kowtow to them in that way.
Are you specifically talking about private insurance companies versus Medicaid or Medicare?
Private insurance companies. Okay. The ones that own this nation.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
So even though, let me rephrase this. Would you say that even though you hate the reasoning that insurance companies are doing this, which is to increase their profit margin, is the outcome not to your liking?
That's a tough question.
That's why I asked it.
I'm going deep, folks. More wine.
I am not bothered by the outcome because the outcome is I see more responsible people every day riding and I see less idiots on the road.
You're not bothered by the outcome. You just don't like where it came from.
I don't like where it came
from. So it's the motivation that's disturbing you as, but
I don't think there's anything wrong with hating the motivation behind a good change.
That's a, okay. That's good. I like that. So I'm going to be a little bit more on the other side of this, I think.
I figured maybe you would be.
Bring it on. Yes.
Basically, laws compelling people to do things I'm by and large against. Again, I think you have the right to be an idiot. I don't like it, and I will think you're an idiot, and I will call you out for being an idiot. But I think it is also your right to be an idiot, even with your own life. So,
but on public property is the problem.
With a public cost.
The public property with a public cost.
Oh, potentially a public cost, depending on your insurance situation, I suppose.
That's,
I'm sorry.
That's where for
me whoa, time out. Yeah. I'm sorry. Most municipalities in this country still have municipality-funded ambulance services. Every single motorcycle accident that it requires someone to be carted away gets a fucking fire engine showing up at, and probably cop cars. That's public cost.
Yeah,
I will 100% agree with you.
And I think you know, kind of what we're talking about here is this sort of ethical conundrum that we all face, right? Which is that, what is the quote unquote right thing to do, and who gets to decide what's right and what's wrong, right?
And why?
And why? Yep. And we've all agreed that wearing helmets is we consider a wise choice. We also all believe in personal freedom and personal liberties and not being told what we can and cannot do with our own bodies, right? And I think this comes down to sort of one of these like unwritten social rules of, yes, I want to make a decision about my own body. However, I'm going to think beyond myself and look at how my actions affect everyone else. And how might my actions affect the greater system? And just not everybody kind of comes to that conclusion, I don't think.
So I'm going to go push back a little bit on Jacob because I've had about 2 seconds to think about this.
Bring it on.
Have a sip, guys. Come on.
Yeah. All right.
Cheers. Don't break the glasses.
Let's fuel this with some booze.
So in the scenario, we're talking about public costs and, you know, if you do something stupid, it comes with the cost of having to have, you know, police, firemen show up to do something. If you were to go and do remodeling on your own home, there's no requirement for you to wear a helmet, have any safety gear attached to your gear. Mm-mm. Is that something that you are also in favor of government making laws about, or no?
When you're remodeling your home, you're not moving at 100 plus miles an hour on public property.
That's true. But you are still, as Jacob pointed out, about firemen and police being involved at risk of the public cost. That's the cost that he pointed out.
Right.
That's why I made that analogy.
I will allow it.
So, allow me to clarify. My point is that when you look at the accounting for whether or not people should or should not have the legal right to not wear helmets, you can't make a claim it's just insurance company profits. You can't make a claim that there is not a social cost. As with every other thing we legislate, it's an issue of cost of enforcement versus whether it's in the best interest of us as a nation. And what I hear time and time again by the by people who don't want to wear helmets is that there's no cost associated to it. There is. Guess what?
I agree with you. There is a cost.
I don't actually have a problem with laws laws that allow for the non-use of helmets. What I just want is an honest statement that there's a social cost to this, yeah, that we will be paying. And I'm okay with paying social costs. I'm a firm Second Amendmenter for that very reason.
Yeah. The only thing I'm going to say to that is, again, I've read a couple studies that indicate that people who do not wear helmets are much more conscious about the fact that they don't have that safety gear and make much more safe decisions than those who do wear proper safety gear. I find those studies fascinating. I would like to read more about them, but that has changed my opinion on the matter as far as government enforcing those laws.
We are running way over on this segment. I think
about
this,
helmets?
What I think would be a great way to close this out is to invite anybody who's listening to share your viewpoints with us. Join us on Discord, follow us on our various social presences, and let's talk about it. Xander, find some links to those articles, post them. Let's get some discussions going.
I would love to.
Actually, Xander, I have them. I'll send them to you.
Poppy?
I would just like to say, as someone who, because earlier you said, oh, the drivers don't care about the cyclists or the motorcyclists. And I have something to say about that. As someone who primarily drives in a car, I am either behind the wheel of a car or I am walking on my own 2 feet most days. I drive a lot. I really don't want to hit you. I really do care. I don't want to hit a motorcycle. I don't want to hit someone on a bike. I need to see you.
Yet you are also talking from the perspective of someone who has both ridden a bicycle and ridden a motorcycle.
This is true. I have this perspective.
A lot of people, the vast majority, doesn't share that perspective.
And I am also really small. I am 5'2" and 107 pounds. And I 155 pounds. Okay, there it is. And, you know, growing up riding a bicycle, I was 5 foot tall, weighed 90 pounds. I was invisible. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Whenever I am on two wheels, I operate under the assumption that I am fucking invisible. So there it is.
Welcome to Portland. You need to get one of those fancy tall bikes. Now let's ride those bikes onto some gaming.
Onto some gaming.
All right. Bringing it to the table. Again, we have our special guest, Poppy, with us here today. And Poppy, I've actually put together some topics specifically to sort of cater to your interests.
Ooh,
for this conversation.
Thank you.
But let's start with you telling us and the listener, what was your first role-playing game?
My memory is a little fuzzy, but
they're
all staring at me. I think my first role-playing game ever was Mage.
Oh.
Yeah, I believe it was 1997.
Wow.
We were at a Bennigan's.
What, not a Denny's?
No, Bennigan's.
That is where I first met you, Nathaniel.
It's a Denny's, yeah.
With my SCA friends and my boyfriend at the time, and I believe we played Mage.
Wow, Poppy's sordid past comes out of the woodwork.
I know.
Was it a tabletop Mage or a live-action Mage?
It was a tabletop.
10-sided dice and roll a shitload of them and try
to
count them.
I don't remember.
Yeah, okay. You know, Bennigan's, places like that do tend to be places to meet new gamers. Xander, we met when I made that call for players for the Fading Suns game.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I do, I like to interview new people to make sure that they're not serial killers or weirdos or smell bad. And then I met you, Xander. I was like, I fucking love this guy. In my brain, like, we had sat down within the first, like, 2 minutes. I'm like, yes, I want this guy at my table. This was in your more punk rock looking days. If you were as dapper as you are now, we would have just walked in the door. I would have shaken your hand, but you're hired. And that would have been, I'm like, all right, cool. Let's go to a strip club. We don't need to talk about gaming. You're it.
So I am, I think, having quite the allergic reaction to this wine. I don't know if you can see how red and blotchy my everything is.
Here, show us more.
Yeah, show everyone, yeah. But if you see the red lines down my face and everything,
Are you sure you're not just getting drunk?
No, I am allergic to either sulfites or oak or both. I haven't figured it out yet. I don't care.
Right on. Well, let's just keep drinking it then.
Yes.
So I do have another question for
you. Yes, sir.
Are you playing anything now?
Just Hammer Crawl.
Hammer Crawl, living for the road.
Oh, my God. Why have I never made that connection? I need to make that a thing that happens.
I sent you the lyric rewrite on that.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, well, I was probably drunk at the time.
Son of a bitch.
Send it to me again. I've lost it.
Yeah, pretty much Hammer Crawl is now the best game ever and the game I will probably only ever play forever.
I'm offended.
Well, Hammer Crawl, listener, is a game that I do. It's a specifically meant to be an old school style game that you sit down and play and everything is randomly generated on the fly at the table. It leads to some hilarious experiences. I wrote it. I put the process together so that dungeon crawling and the concept of the meat grinder would be a lot more approachable to noobs. You're at a convention or you're at a game store or you're at a demo event. You got a game, you sit down, you want to play, and you want people to play who are new to the hobby or didn't sign up for something in advance at the convention website. They are looking for something to play, and you want them to be able to sit down and play immediately without any introduction. And that's kind of what Hammer Crawl is. And that leads to the topic that I really wanted to bring in here, which was learning how to game as a total noob.
I am the person to talk to about that. If you heard the Character Jam episode, I ask a lot of questions. What is this? What? Which dice? What am I doing? What are you talking about?
And I know that we've been hanging out for a while, and you've been gaming apparently since Mage and 97.
No, oh goodness, no. No. I played Mage in 1997. I hated it because every time I said I was going to do something, the GM was like, no, you don't. You fall out of a tree instead. I have no idea. I didn't get to do anything. I was very confused. I had
Stop
no idea
rolling
what was going
ones
on.
And that's no longer a problem.
Yeah, I don't even remember there being dice. Like, I don't. Anyway.
Get good, noob. Oh, wait, sorry. This is a positive podcast.
I think the next game I played was then Monster Hearts in like 2011 or 2012 or whenever that was.
I can see you being an awesome Monster Hearts player.
Okay.
Hold on.
Okay.
Monster Hearts, for anybody who isn't aware, is a game about supernatural teenage horrific romance. It is the game. It is Twilight. It is all of those Buffy the Vampire Slayer. If it's a supernatural, if it's a paranormal teenage romance with horrific elements, then Monster Hearts is the game that you would play that in. It is powered by the apocalypse, as they say, and that what that ultimately means to you, dear listener, is that all of the dice are rolled by the players, and thus all of their doom is brought onto themselves. As with many games in that genre, it's the perfect game for paranormal teenage romance. Poppy?
I do really like Monster Hearts, and I do really get into it because that's the kind of shit that I read. It's not shit, it's wonderful. I have a really stressful job, and when I'm off the clock, I like to read me some young adult urban fantasy romance smut brain candy.
Yep.
And Monster Hearts is basically take like the Vampire Diaries, Twilight, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and make it into a role-playing game. And it is a lot of fun, but after a few rounds of playing it, I started to feel a little uncomfortable with the like, we are all teenagers trying to have sex with each other. Mm-hmm. And I am a woman in my 30s. I got a little uncomfortable with it.
That ended up being the main reason why I stopped playing it and got rid of the books. Like, I just, as an adult, especially an adult white male, I feel weird role-playing teenagers fucking.
And I try so hard most of the time to not be like an actual creeper. Like, if I can be kind of...
Trying, huh? Trying.
if I can be sort of a cute, like, lovable, adorable, like, fun-loving creeper, like, that's great. Like a kind of a little weirdo. But, like, an actual creeper is something I don't want to do.
So just out of curiosity, what's the difference between, I mean, I kind of know, but between a role-playing game in which it is about being kind of smutty and having sex with each other as opposed to a novel that you are reading?
Third-person perspective?
I mean, that's kind of what I was, but I want to hear Poppy.
I think that it has to do with, am I reading about a thing, about a fictional character that has been created and I'm completely removed from it versus I am inventing this scenario and I'm making these choices and living this fantasy out. And that's where I get kind of like, ooh.
That's where it is for me too.
Yeah.
I think that's an awesome distinction too. Why, you know, when people ask, you know, why do you role play to begin with? And I think it's just about being a character and it's fun as opposed to reading about a character.
Personally, I role play because I want to fantasize about interesting, strange, hilarious, bizarre, and horrific new experiences, and sometimes even sexy experiences. I have sex in a lot of my games. I think sex is a human experience. I think gamer characters, they just fuck all the time, even in my D&D games. But
apparently, I'm in your wrong gaming group for
that. Yeah, not with that group. But that again is a topic for another time, and it's entirely up to the feelings of the table. But for me, Monster Hearts role-playing teenagers fucking is just as squicky as playing something like role-playing children fucking. Not going to do it. It's just, you know, no. It's not for me. It's not for me. I'm sure a lot of other people like it. It kind of squicked me out eventually.
I agree. That's why I'm actually, just to do a small aside, that's why I'm a bigger fan of Monster of the Week, which is also a Powered by the Apocalypse World engine game, but you can do the Monster Hearts Buffy-esque style thing, but you also can, but you actually have to work to do that. It's far more given to supernatural, et cetera, et cetera.
So we're diving into the apocalypse here, and we should table this for another episode.
Oh, I have the
perfect. We can talk way more about it. But I want to bring this back to the noob element of play here. So, Poppy?
I have the perfect universe for an adult version of Monster Hearts to happen, but more on that later. So I have a theater background. I actually have a Bachelor of Arts in acting and directing, but I never fancied myself very good at improv. And I think that one of the greatest sort of barriers to entry for me getting into tabletop role playing game was feeling really self-conscious about, like, I'm not going to be any good. Like, I don't know what to do. I'm not going to make interesting decisions. I'm just not going to be very good. Everyone's going to hate me. Like, whatever, you know, whatever the sort of, you know, anxious kind of crap going on in my brain was. And really, like, it's what I've found is, I mean, again, like, I'm kind of this extroverted performer by nature in a lot of ways, but I never fancied myself very good at improv. Like, give me a script and I will create my character and I will read the lines and I will take direction and da 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 da. But, like, coming up with my own stuff, like, on the fly was really, really kind of nerve-wracking at first. And that, I think, you know, like, part of that, I think you just kind of have to, like, practice and just kind of get over it. Like just keep doing it until it no longer bothers you. But I think the other big thing is, who are you gaming with? Are the people you with, are they going to be really cool and laid back and be like, yes, we want to help you. You're a new player. This is awesome. And is the GM, like, going to help you along? And it's really about, who are you with?
I experienced this a lot too when I met Nathaniel over here, because I had gamed a little bit. He was clearly much more of a gamer than I was. And as you're saying, Poppy, the people that you are with make all the difference in the world. There have been people that I've done nerdy things with where they're like, ugh, you don't know what this is? Ugh. And they just kind of scoff at you, make you feel like an idiot, and it turns you off to the entire experience. Whereas with NPC over here, you know, he was just so gracious in letting me in. He let me ask the stupid questions because he liked the ideas that I came up with.
And I love answering the quote unquote stupid questions because they show an interest. They show that you are paying attention.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
it. They show that you are listening to what the GM or the group is saying.
Yeah. And so I will say really quick that just the opportunity to have someone like that, like you have to seek out a group that really wants to embrace you for the ideas that you have, because I've had people that have known so much more about RPGs than I have and are just, their characters just suck. Their scenarios are terrible. They might have the number crunching abilities. And I've also had the experience too, kind of where I fall in with some of this is that I'm a pretty weird creative person. I got like crazy ideas to bring to the table. And
you do.
And I know you've said some of your favorite characters ever have been weird ones that I've come up with. And that, to me anyways, is much more important than having the technicalities down to a T.
Well, and I think that, you know, as you were saying, like, it's having that energy of, like, I'm so excited I get to teach you this thing, is as I have been more involved in sort of, like, the nerd and geek culture, like, over the last 7 or 8 years... One of the things I've learned is that very thing of people, you know, saying like, oh my God, you don't know blah, blah, blah. Like, have you been living under a rock? Like, and that's really a pretty fucking jerky thing to say.
Yes.
And I didn't really realize why. I grew up very middle class, very privileged. And like, I'd seen all the TV shows. I've seen all the movies, blah, 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 blah. So when somebody was like, it's like, oh my God, you haven't seen this TV show? They're like, girl, I grew up poor. We didn't have cable. Like, fuck you. And it took me
a really long thing.
Yeah, and it took me a really long time to sort of catch on. Like, oh, that's really shitty. And I finally did, luckily. And now, so my new kind of mantra of life is to, when somebody says, oh my God, I've never seen Big Trouble in Little China, my reaction is now, I'm so excited for you that you get to see it for the first time.
Yeah. That is such a great perspective right there, is that rather than shaming somebody, that you get to have the excitement of experience their first experience, kind of much like Nathaniel showing me Firefly for the first time.
That was a wonderful experience.
Because you said Serenity's coming out in 2 days. Buckle up. We have a lot to watch.
And then you had your heart broken.
I did have my heart broken, and then I watched the entire series and then had my heart broken all over again.
So this is going to be a reoccurring theme throughout this podcast with me, and I referenced it once, I believe in episode 1, maybe episode 2. But like I've mentioned, I'm fairly active in the world of geek culture activism, and I want to fully endorse what Poppy just said. One of the biggest damaging behaviors by people within geek culture is that knowledge check bullshit. I mean, rather than tearing people down for it, I just want to hear more and more of you out there embrace what Poppy said and go and say, rather than you don't know what Big Trouble in Little China is, go, I am so excited for you.
Exactly. And I want to impart, I want you all, this is if I can impart anything to the world, it's what one of my most favorite professional sort of mentors taught me. I want you all to repeat after me right now, and that is curiosity, not judgment.
Curiosity, not judgment.
Well done.
I like that, yeah.
And I think it's so true. There are so many things that are of interest to people, and they feel like there is a barrier to even get into it. You know, I know there's a whole cliche with the fake geek girl thing or whatever, but there's also a lot of...
Oh, God damn that shit.
I know.
Can I just say that just makes my skin crawl? Yeah.
You can't just say that. But I just want to say that we really, especially at this podcast too, we want to embrace anybody who has curiosity in all of these things. We want to encourage you. Ask us questions. Show curiosity. We want to show you.
So, Poppy, I want to close this section out with you, just as we've opened it up. Is there any last advice that you would give to noobs who you think would like it, but haven't had the chance?
Just do it, you know? like Nike says, oh dear. Just, I would say, find a group of people who's going to embrace your newness. You know, interview them, get a sense of how they are. Are they being kind of judgmental? Are they being kind of closed off and cliquish? Or are they all very excited and enthusiastic about having new blood at the table? I think a good gaming group is going to welcome new blood and is going to also know how to give you kind of some constructive feedback about, like, you know, how to game and what are good kind of strategies for gaming. And they're going to answer those. They're going to answer your questions in an enthusiastic way. And they're not, like we said, they're not going to shame you or judge you for not knowing what the hell you're doing.
And what if they do?
Find another group.
Yeah. No gaming is better than bad gaming, especially if you're new.
And we were all new ones.
It doesn't have to be that bad.
Yeah. We're all new ones.
All new ones. Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter, you know, what your background is or where you came from. But I do think that, you know, we owe it to everybody to go and say, yeah, we were new once too. We walked in with no knowledge and just an interest. And we all met that person. For me, it's Nathaniel that, you know, really went and took my hand and said, yeah, let's do this. Let's go and have a great gaming session.
And everybody at this table has seen my dice guide. And I'm going to say, just like, don't be ashamed to do whatever it is you need to do in order to be able to game.
Oh, I love this.
Isn't it adorable? I have a really hard time with spatial recognition and numbers. I've got some dyscalculia and I'm not great at sort of spatial reasoning because my brain is interesting. So I made myself a dice guide. I made a little piece of paper and I lay out my dice and I label them. So when Nathaniel or whoever says roll a d12, I know what the fuck I'm doing.
Just a quick thing, Poppy. I want to do a special thank you because when I first saw your dice guide, something clicked for me and I put together a sheet just like that, that was a fairly high-end graphic thing that I put together because several people in my life, including my brother, struggle with autism and they like to game.
Mm-hmm.
And I put together a dice guide just like yours. And so far, yay, we are up to 4 thank yous.
That's awesome. I'm so happy.
And we'll have a picture of that dice guide in our links at the show notes.
Both of them, I hope.
I will be sending the PDF.
That's fantastic.
And now that we've been drinking, let's talk about drinking.
Oh, God.
And now we're talking booze. We've been drinking, and it's clear if you've been listening that this wine is at least getting to me. Probably the rest of you. I don't know. So far, what do you think of it?
It's very drinkable. It's just like middle of the, I'm trying to figure out how to explain this. Like it's sort of middle of the road for me. It's not so light that I don't really notice what I'm drinking, and it's not so heavy that I'm like, oh God, I can only have like one glass of this. Like something like a Cabernet or a Norton. Oh, and hopefully we can talk about Norton at a later date. It's a very thick, heavy wine. And like after one glass or so, I'm like, oh shit, I'm done. This is like the perfect medium balance wine. Like I know I'm drinking wine. I'm enjoying the experience, but I can keep on drinking it.
Xander, what do you think?
I think that this probably came from grapes.
It did.
You're not much of a wine drinker, are you?
I am very much not a wine drinker. I think part of that came from the mentality that I had growing up when my father, who was a huge, very much a cook and a chef and made great food all the time, and our neighbors growing up, they often said, well, you should try to take some wine classes so you can go and pair, you know, the food that you make with these better wines and everything. And my dad was very much a two-buck chuck kind of guy. And his whole mentality was, why would I pay money to go to a class to find out that I need to spend more money on wine? Yeah. It's kind of the reaction I expected from you, Poppy. But
I've got something to say about that, sure.
I'm sure you do. But I've had a lot of different types of wine. I've had fancy wines. I've gone wine tasting. I've had, I don't know, 15, 20 different varietals. I can't even tell you. But I, at the end of the day, you know, you give me, you know, Yellowtail and you give me some really fancy white, and I probably couldn't tell you much about the two.
I'm similar. I've never had a tongue for wine. I've never... I don't think I actually had wine until I was in my late 20s or early 30s. I was not a wine person. My wine of choice is Carlo Rossi, because you can
buy it.
Hell yeah.
At the store. Like, my former roommate and I would gather together on when we lived just around the corner over in Cully. We would play Resident Evil, but our Resident Evil night was we would play single player Resident Evil as a pair. Oh. We'd have one person with a laser pointer and a strategy guide guiding the other person through the map on the screen. But we would go together over to the Albertsons. We'd buy like two big old jugs of Carlo Sangria because that was the best.
Oh, hell yeah.
We actually trudged through a blizzard just so we could get our Carlo Sangria to play Resident Evil. And so I don't really have a sophisticated palate. However, my extended time of hanging out with Poppy over here has taught me some things about it. And what I will say as a result of that is I like this wine. It is not what I expected to put in my mouth.
Oh, really?
I mean, I will say this about this wine. There's definitely kind of some honey elements that I think are lovely, a little bit of notes of citrus that I'm kind of getting mixed in with that. So I can, which is funny too, because you throw a beer in front of me, I can give you tasty notes all day long.
Yeah, it almost tastes like mead. It's got
it's a little meaty. Yeah. But I will say that the only wine that I actually sometimes seek out is a good tawny port. And I don't, ooh, that's not a wine. Wow.
Well, then, Jacob, why don't you tell us how you feel?
Well, no, I'm going to talk about tawny port for a second is what I'm going to do.
Well, let's save that for a deeper episode. I do want to hear what Jacob likes about this wine.
So, in fact, you both have touched, all three of you, in fact, have touched on my opinion on this.
You think it's better than Rossi, right?
Oh, yes, I think okay. It's better than Rossi. And
how much better?
Well, that depends. Is it straight Rossi or is it Jacob's?
Sangria.
Or is it Jacob's tears?
Straight Sangria.
Oh, straight Sangria. World's better.
I bet Carlo Rossi makes a fantastic Kalimoto.
Carlo Rossi Corporation, if you're looking to sponsor a podcast, please let us know.
I would be okay with that.
And in defense of Rossi.
And some night when this entire podcast crew takes a vacation, perhaps Jacob will make up a batch of Jacob's tears and share it with y'all, which is its base ingredient is Carlo Rossi.
Fantastic.
No, anyways, so my opinion of Tears of Vulcan, you touched on it. It has honey notes. It
nailed it.
It speaks a lot to mead. In fact, if you are a mead lover who does not usually care for wine, this would be the wine for you. So going hard off the deep end for me.
Oh, boy.
Girl, get it.
Oh, God. So this has some sexy, sexy mixes of oak. You know, I'm really waiting to hear how Poppy breaks this down. My guess is we have a mix of New World American oak and some Old World French, probably with some char barrel. I can almost bet there's a little stainless in there. But this is a beautiful honey. And for those of you who go deep in the paint for your non-standard wines, if you like Basque wines, this is a wine you should try.
That was English, correct? Yes.
It was English, Basque. Yes.
Yeah. I know some of those words.
I also speak English. I'm getting a lot of kind of peach or tangerine kind mm-hmm. of notes with this, which is really lovely.
That's what actually brings out the call to people who like Basque wines. Mm-hmm.
And again, it's very drinkable. So what I would pair this with food-wise, and I think Nathaniel may agree with me on this.
Tacos or pizza?
Sushi.
No, baby doll. This, I think, would go amazing with a melted Morrison.
Oh, God. Hold on. Let me change my paint.
I know, right? So the
melted Morrison is the best grilled cheese sandwich I've ever had in my life. It is also the only grilled cheese sandwich I will ever pay money for.
That but, makes sense. Yeah. Oh, because I would pair this with the Cubano.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A really good grilled cheese sandwich, I think, would pair extremely well with this wine.
God, now I want a melted Morrison in my clothes right now. Ah!
I saw that look you were giving me, Xander, and that is because I grew up eating Cubanos with dark rum.
Ooh.
No, the look I gave you was me trying to wrap my head around wine making food taste better because I'm ignorant like that, and I'll acknowledge that, but I also don't want to double the price of my meal.
No, it's not about, like, is the food going to make the wine taste better, or is the wine going to make the food taste better? Like, it's more about if you've got good food and good wine, you're going to have a good time.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and what I kind of, when I talk about like pairing, I don't talk about like, oh, what's the proper pairing for this? I think about when I drink this wine, like, what do I want? What do I crave?
So Xander, think about pairings in, you can think about them in a very casual sense. Like, you're having a burger. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Are you going to have a glass of wine with that burger? Or are you going to have a beer with that burger? Are you going to have what?
No, I definitely understand the concepts.
But you'll have a slice of pepperoni pizza. Well, you'll probably have a different beer with that pizza. You might have
Tempranillo.
It depends on the pizza.
I'm not even getting into wines just yet, but different drinks will pair better with different things. So, you know, you got some crackers with some cheese on them. Yeah, it's not really a PBR night, but it might be better for
what kind of cheese? Wine. What kind of cheese?
Easy cheese in a can.
Easy cheese in a can.
Sharp
PBR,
cheddar.
PBR.
Sharp
PBR.
So you're going PBR. You're going sharp cheddar, Tillamook sharp cheddar. What's your cracker?
Rosemary.
So you go to Trader Joe's, you get some Carmenillo. And that's what you pair it with.
There you go. So, burger, Syrah?
Cabernet Sauvignon, ma'am.
Oh, interesting.
Depends. Burger with or without cheese?
This is getting really heated in here.
Without?
Whoa.
I give it to you.
Whoa. Burger without cheese? Get the fuck out of my house.
I'm sorry,
burger with wine?
Wait, last time
I
checked.
Get the fuck out of here.
Okay, so a burger... Okay, I'm so...
Is this a rock?
When I think
No. You know what? No. This is America.
Budweiser, America, motherfucker. I'm going to
have
a Budweiser
beer with our burgers.
With my burger.
I don't like that German word you just said there. I don't know what that is.
Budvar.
We have Pabst.
Last time I checked, burger was a German word.
You shut up.
I don't care if we're drinking old German earlier.
All right, you got
this is new America.
So, if I was going to get my favorite burger, which I am not ashamed to admit is a Burgerville seasoned turkey burger, I'm going to drink a Syrah with that.
Okay, I will.
You're going to give me
you
that?
You are invalidating yourself, ma'am.
We've just got on this insane tangent here. Let's bring it back to the Tears of Vulcan.
Bring it back to Tears of Vulcan.
So, Poppy, you have a statement prepared.
I do have a statement prepared. Okay, so as I said earlier, this is a blend. It is a 63% Viognier, 21%.
What is that?
It's a varietal of white grape.
Okay.
21% Pinot Gris and a 16% Muscat. Those are all varietals of white wines.
I'm surprised it's only 16% because the Muscat comes through far stronger.
It's really interesting, isn't it?
Well, I think it's a stronger wine in general.
These grapes come from the Chehalem Mountains AVA, and AVA stands for American Viticultural Area. It is located in Clackamas, Yamhill, and Washington counties of northwestern Oregon, and it is entirely contained within the Willamette Valley AVA.
I understand that it was something interesting about the woman who put this wine together. Do you have anything on her?
Because she's the owner of Day Wines. Her name is, I believe her name is Brianna Day. And she constructed this wine based off of her love of particular kinds of wines. So she discovered that there are these vineyards in the Chehalem Mountain AVA that were growing basically like Viognier and Pinot Gris, like across the street from each other.
Right. That makes sense.
And this Muscat that was like right down the way. So the grapes are from, the Viognier and the Pinot Gris are from Le Beau Vineyard. And the Muscat grapes are from, I'm going to butcher this and I'm so sorry, Namarkini?
Somebody.
I'm going to keep passing that down.
Yeah,
you had it right.
Namarkini? Yeah. Okay, yeah, the muscat is from Namarkini. And
that's the way I've always heard it pronounced.
Yeah, so you can check them out at daywines.com. And they have their own tasting room in Dundee, which is actually not that far from here. And I really hope I can go someday.
Poppy, do we need to take a road trip for the wine snobs visit wine or wine tasting rooms?
I think we do. I think we do.
Y'all have fun there.
I just want to
say. We're dragging your ass.
Yeah. I just want to say as an aside that the joke that NPC has come up with is that I'm the wannabe wine snob. And I want to say for the record, and we can maybe cut this and put this back in later, is that I detest snobbery in all of its forms. Since as soon as I got old enough and wise enough to detect classism and snobbery and all of that bullshit, I detest snobbery. So my goal as a wine hobbyist is to find wines that are accessible and under $30. Now, my favorite wine does clock in at about $115, but $30 or less, you can find great wines.
Holy cow.
We can talk more about expensive wines in another episode.
On another episode. But this bottle of Tears of Vulcan we paid $30 for, which is a little bit on the higher end of what I usually like to spend for a wine. Okay, but going back to about Tears of Vulcan, it was fermented on its skins for 3 weeks, which is where it gets that lovely orange color from. It was when it was finished with its regular alcoholic fermentation, it was pressed off and put into one Russian oak barrel with an acacia head.
Oh,
I know, girl, right? Yeah.
Wow.
And for neutral barrels. So no oak.
I want to see what their Brix breakdown was.
Then it went through the malolactic fermentation, and then it was sulfured and bottled.
I again want to extend thanks to Dan and Talina at the Mom and Pop Wine Shop for recommending this to us. They were very outspoken about how interesting this wine was and how they had it at a private tasting, and then they took it home and finished the bottle because it was that good.
It was that good, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, Tears of Vulcan. This is something new. It's got a cool bottle. It looked neat. It had an interesting story.
Bottle is
rad. I figured I would bring it today. It's definitely not something you'd find at a dive bar.
Nope.
But on this wine-themed episode, it's a good one. Jacob?
Very quickly, Xander, as being not a wine guy, do you actually like this?
It doesn't suck.
Okay.
Awesome.
Then let us make the recommendation that Tears of Vulcan is the first Biker Dice and Bars endorsed wine.
Yes.
To not suck it.
To not suck it.
This is the last call
for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol. Get going. Drink up, drink up, drink up, then order again.
I just guess the way that I feel about this bottle of wine is that for $30 for 750 milliliters of alcohol, I do feel like I could find things that were much more my taste. And that's
oh, definitely.
Absolutely, you could. Yeah.
I am a person that can easily find something to drink for significantly less money.
Oh, one of our favorite wines is like $9.
One of my favorites is $4.50.
Yeah, totally. Exactly.
Carlo Rossi over here, y'all. Carlo Rossi.
I have a special place in my heart for both Thunderbird and...
You know what?
Old Mad Dog 2020.
That's when I started young, and I started there, but I'm not going to keep going there. But.
And there's nothing wrong with Two Buck Chuck. Right?
It's all there's about, a lot wrong with Two
just,
Buck Chuck.
No, it's all about, it, much like with, again, like I said, I detest snobbery. It's not about how much you paid for it or where it was made or whose virgin hands touched it. It's what do you like? What do you want to put in your mouth? What do you enjoy?
I do like putting things in my mouth.
Yes, we know.
That is entirely true. Now, when you say Two Buck Chuck, do you just mean inexpensive wine in general?
Inexpensive wine in general. I mean, it doesn't fucking matter if you want to pay $3 for a bottle of wine or if you want to pay $150 for a bottle of wine. It all comes from...
I totally agree with you. Charles Shaw has no excuse.
Ladies and gentlemen, girls, ladies, all of y'all, it's all fucking rotten grapes.
Exactly.
Okay?
It's all rotten grapes. Some of them taste better than others.
It's all rotten grapes. And they've been stumped. Rotten grapes do you like?
So, Xander, you look like you're about to murder all of us right now. You know, if we ever do make a trip out to a winery, I definitely want to take you.
Because we need a designated driver.
Truth.
I just want you to be there because I'm not a wine snob at all. And oftentimes when I go wine tasting with Poppy and her friends and our mutual acquaintances, you just need someone to go with you.
The wine tastes like this.
And I'm like, uh-huh. Well, the wine tastes like booze and it's getting me drunk. Because that's how I feel about most wine.
And that's the reason why I do accept invitations to go to wine tastings. Because at the end of the day, I know that it's alcohol and it's going to make me feel okay.
So let's go ahead and close this out. Xander, you wanted to give a special shout out that I wholeheartedly endorse.
So as you have probably heard in our first three episodes, we have a super awesome, catchy jingle intro and outro. And I want to give a super special shout out to Skip Von Kusky, who was the guy who put that together for us. Skip Von Kusky is one of the most, you wouldn't know it by the song he made for us, but he's one of the most amazing cellists of all time.
He is prolific.
Prolific.
Yeah. If you've never heard of the Portland Cello Project, almost all of the most amazing solos on that are done by him. He now heads the Portland Cello Project. He was a part of a band that I was in for a long time called Vagabond Opera. He is a super awesome person. We've had many great experiences and many great dive bars together. And he is a guest who has expressed interest in coming on the show in regards to dive bars.
We look forward to having him.
And he has also said he would especially love to go if we do a little outing at a dive bar. So, Skip Von Kusky, mad shout out to you for our awesome Bikers Dice and Bar theme song and outro. Much love.
Woo!
Skip, you put that song together in record time.
Hey, Nathaniel, question for you. Who did our amazing graphics?
Our logo was done by my good friend Alex Hakobian. Alex and I have worked together on a gaming project of his called Broadsword, which is a modern remake of the HeroQuest board game with a few balances and additions for both tabletop and digital tabletop, like Roll20 or something. I did the editing for him. He helped me out with the logo. And he, again, it's record time. Like, he popped that logo out in basically a weekend, and it was way more than I even asked.
And NPC, will we be able to find contact information for both these people on the show notes?
It's already on the website.
Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Dive Bars.
Thanks for listening, folks. This has been Bikers, Dice, and Bars. I'm Nathaniel.
This is Jess Jacob.
Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
And again, we were joined by
Poppy Beaujolais.
And you can find us on breakfastpuppies.com. You can contact us individually by our names at breakfastpuppies.com or at bikersdiceandbars.com. All of the social information is online. You just find it there. Thanks for listening. And as always, keep the rubber side down,
shiny side up,
and always tip your bartender.
And always drink responsibly. And may your dice always roll criticals. And this is our fourth episode, and we're a little drunk. Thanks for listening.
Yay!
Thanks for joining us, friend. We've reached the end of Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your car. But Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Bikes, Dice, and Bars.
Bikes, Dice, and Bars.
Yep.
Deo.
Deo. Daylight come and we want to go home.
Day. Mi se de, mi se de, mi se de, mi se de, mi se de.
Daylight come and we want to go home. 6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot, oh!
Daylight come and we want to go home.
I don't know the rest of the song.
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me bananas.
Daylight come and we want to go home. Oh, wait, I got one. Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bone. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You're loading 16 tons. What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
It's astounding. Time is fleeting.
Madness takes its toll.
But listen closely.
Not for very much longer.
I've got to keep control. But I remember
doing the time warp. Drinking those moments when
all right.
The blackness would head me and a voice would be calling.
Okay, so Bikers, Dice, and Bars will apparently also be doing a karaoke night one of these nights.
I owe my soul.
Oh, my favorite part is that we're not even doing the song that we started singing earlier.
I don't
well,
even remember.
Kick us off, Sander.
B-double-E-double-R-U-N,
beer run.
B-double-E-double-R-U-N,
beer run.
All you need is a
sober driver.
All you need is a Tanner, Fiverr, cars and keys, and a sober driver.
B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run.